Good morning. My name is Linda, and I've been a member of Al-Anon since 1987. And thank you, Angie. Those were very kind words. I'm always amazed that when I'm sitting on my couch and somebody calls and asks me to come share at a convention, it seems like a good idea when I'm on my couch. Right now, it doesn't look so good. So I'm going to have to ask for something. Lois Wilson, who was the co-founder of Al-Anon, she was married to Bill. Someone asked her what she did in the moment of silence before we do the serenity prayer. And she said, I invite God to the meeting. And I've witnessed the presence of a wonderful God of our understanding here many times. But right now I need to ask for a moment of silence. And if you'd be willing to ask the God of your understanding to come and hang out with us and give me the words I'm supposed to have, I'd appreciate it. A moment of silence. Thank you. Now, Lois Wilson was quite an incredible co-founder of Al-Anon. You know, she her birthday was March 4th, so she just recently, you know, she's since passed away, but her birthday was March 4th. And she said that was a slogan, March 4th, okay? So I'm going to march forth into this speech or this talk or this sharing. And then you want to know how I qualify to be here? Is because I dearly love alcoholics. I love you. And I love to be able to come here and share with this group of people. What an incredible, I go to a lot of conferences. This one is something. And not only is it something, rolling on the river, it's also 21 years old. That makes you legally able to not drink, right? I would like to thank the committee and the wonderful bag that I got with all the goodies in it. Everything's just been really, really wonderful until right now. And I don't know. I don't know why I have so much angst, because the only thing I have to tell you is that I love alcoholics in these rooms and outside these rooms. And I'm really good at loving them. I marry them. I divorce them. I marry them. I divorce them. I call them uncle. I call them dad. I give birth to them. I mean, you know, I love alcoholics. And for that, you want me to come and tell my story, you know? And I really do have a gift. And that is the gift of loving the alcoholic and being able to pick them out in a room. I mean, you know, I can walk into the grocery store, or I can walk into the airport when somebody's going to pick us up and we don't really know that one. And I'll go, yep, there's that alcoholic that we're going to ride with him. I have this gift, and I'm so good at it that wonderful Scott gave me these business cards. He said, you could really help our recovery community. I said, really? He goes, oh, yeah, you know, I want to help, you know. And he says, yeah. He said, I'm going to give you these, and he gave me 500 of them. I'm going to give you these little business cards. And he said, you know, when you're standing in line to pick up the dry cleaning and you look over there and there's somebody you're kind of attracted to, you could give them one of these business cards. I go, okay. So one side has my name, my phone number. The back side says this, hi, my name is Linda. I am a member of Al-Anon. I find you attractive, so I suggest you go to the nearest treatment center and have an assessment done. You know, just cut to the chase, you know, that's it. And so my story into the disease, or the disease of alcoholism, like many of us, it starts before I was born. And I want to tell you a little bit about my parents. They grew up in Oklahoma, and both of my parents lived without water and electricity at some point in their lifetime. My dad was the oldest of five children. His mom used to have to take the kids and hide them in the cornfield, because when their dad would come home, he had been drinking, and he was one of those violent drunks. And he was so violent that that they would have to hide from him. He did not provide the food for the table. So my dad, as a young boy at about 12, 13, 14 years old, he would go out into the woods and he would hunt down a squirrel or rabbit and he'd bring it home to his mom to cook for dinner so he and his brothers and sisters could have something to eat on the table. And this was the lifestyle that he had. And I think about my grandmother, about being married to this violent alcoholic. And yet one of her children she named Joy. So she had the ability to love alcoholics, you know, she did. So my dad, just on some regular day, came home from hunting, and he probably had a rabbit, and he had his gun, and he opened the door, and he saw his dad taking the metal poker from the fireplace, and he was beating his mom, who was pregnant with her last child. And my dad, without thinking, took the gun, and he shot it, and he killed his own father. That's extreme alcoholism. And as you would think, the sheriff came because this was a homicide. And the sheriff came, and he didn't take my dad off to jail. He took my dad out of the county. He took my dad out of state because he knew that the brothers, the uncles, would come, and they would track this young boy down, and they would take revenge. So that's the story that I have of my alcoholism. My mother fell in love. She was still in high school. She fell in love with my dad. They eloped. And I think they must have had some really, really happy times. My dad was an amputee. He only had one arm. When he was a young boy in this Oklahoma small town, when he was born, a blood clot was moving up his arm, and the doctor didn't know anything to do but saw it off. And so my dad, was an amputee. And so they told my mother that when she married him, he'd never amount to anything. But I have to tell you, in one generation, my dad became a very, very successful businessman, and he turned their lives around. And so they got married, and they'd been married a while, and then they're going to have this baby, and I don't think they knew at the time this was going to be an only child. I don't think only children parents don't really know that at the time it's only going to be one, but they're all excited. They're going to have this baby, and then this baby gets born, and it's me. And the first message I got from my parents was that I was a disappointment because they didn't even have a girl's name picked out. They were so sure that I was going to be a boy and that I was going to be my dad's other arm and, you know, that we were going to live happily ever after. So I had to apologize for my birth, for being a female. Now, my parents loved me. They provided for me. One thing about being an only child, you get all of the budget for shoes. You get all the budget for clothes. You get all the back seat when you go on a vacation. You know, nobody looked out my window. So I have so much to be grateful for my parents. Now, you think with the history that my dad witnessed in his dad that maybe he would stay away from the drink. But I have to tell you that I saw my dad drink probably every day of my life. I saw my dad drunk a lot. But he was a successful businessman, so it just looked like part of the society. He would have to take very important clients out for dinner. And being an only child, I would go with my parents. We would be traveling with my dad. He was a traveling salesman. I grew up in Odessa, Texas. If you want to know what my life was like, look at Under the Friday Night Lights. That's my hometown. I'll give you a little bit more information. I graduated from high school in 1964. I truly was living under the Friday Night Lights. Now, so you don't have to get your calculators out. I'm working on 73, okay? Here I am with my parents going all over, and I can remember as a young child that we would go into the bar, and it was always dark, and they had those big cozy chairs, and I can remember as a young girl, I would sit in those chairs, and my feet would stick straight out. That's how young I was. I'm talking like, you know, 4 or 5. I remember the smell of a bar and the people laughing, and I remember sitting there and then going into dinner and having drinks and coming back having drinks. Many, many times a bartender would take mercy on this little kid in this little chair, and they would bring me a whole little glass full of those red cherries with those little sword toothpicks, you know, for me to play with. I don't even like those to this day. But But it seemed like I had everything going for me, and I'd see my dad drink, and I wouldn't think too much about it because it was at the country club or it was to entertain. Now in high school, I'd go over and I'd pick up my girlfriend in the morning, and her dad worked in the oil field. He worked the graveyard shift, so his 5 o'clock for the end of the day work actually was 5 o'clock in the morning. So I would come into her house to pick her up, and he'd be sitting there in his underwear, and he'd be taking a bottle and he'd be drinking out of it, and then he'd put it back down, and I'd go, "Whoa, that there must be something wrong with this." So see, I had judgment, because that night I would go with my parents out to the country club, and my dad might fall asleep in the mashed potatoes, but since the environment was so nice, it didn't seem like anything was wrong. So I grew up with a lot. I grew up with a lot of clothes. I grew up with a lot of travel. I grew up with a lot of shoes. I grew up with a lot of dreams that I didn't even know I had. But I graduated from high school, and I'm still living at home. I'm going to the junior college there in Odessa. And one day I'm going across campus, and this young man's coming toward me. I could have given him one of these cards. And this man, this young man asked me out, and we dated for 2 weeks, and then he asked me to marry him, and that seemed like such a wonderful idea. So I went to my parents, and I said, "We're going to get married." And they said, "Well, okay, but shouldn't he have a job first?" And we're going, "That's just details. We'll work it out, you know?" And so I got married in 1965. Quite honestly, things were a bit different then. And I'd been a good girl for as long as I could be. Y'all can interpret that. I wore the white dress. I marched down the aisle. I married this young man that I'd known for 6 months. And we lived happily ever after for about the first week. Mm-hmm. And then I'm nesting and playing house and cooking dinner, and he's not there. And he would fail to show up, and he would fail to make the payments for the electricity, and he would fail to be this happily ever after couple that I'm so sure we're supposed to be. Now, we're college students, and we kept going from, he kept saying, "Well, it's going to be better if we go down to Austin, or it's going to be better if we go up to Denton." And so I would follow him around, and all the first years we were married, we were still college students, and we got married in 65. Our daughter was born in 1968. We're still college students, and he still doesn't have a job. But now I'm thinking, as a parent, now we're going to get it together. We are going to live happily ever after. And we did, because he came in one day and he says, "I've got a job." And what had happened, he had gone down to the local saloon. He had auditioned with his guitar, and he started making more money in 1 week than we'd seen in months. So not only did he not have a job, he also had a career. He was no longer going to be a college student. He was going to be an entertainer in bars. So I just thought that was wonderful. And I'm still being a college student. I'm still being the mom. I've got the picket fence, and he's bringing home the money. And then after about 2 weeks, he said, "Well, they want me to go to Dallas." And so I've got a contract that I'm going to go to Dallas, and I'm going to sing there in that bar for like 30 days, and then I'm going to go over to Nacogdoches, and I'm going to sing in that bar for about 30 days. Then I'm going to go to Houston, and this exciting. And I said, "Well, yeah, I'll start packing," because I didn't think he should go without adult supervision. And so I packed up the kids' toys, a hot plate, our daughter, her bags, her diaper bag, and we started living in hotels. We went from living in college couples or married couples, dorm facilities, whatever, and then now we're living in hotels, and we are living happily ever after. He's got a job. He would go down to work every night. He would come home after work. I'm upstairs with this baby in this hotel room, and he'd come home from work, and about, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, and he'd kind of act like and smell like and look like he'd been to a party, but it was work. So that had to be okay, but I'm getting pretty bored up there. He's going down every night to sing, except for Sunday night in the bar, and he's coming home, and I'm in the hotel room, and they all look alike, and the next city looks alike. I've got this baby. I'm getting bored. I'm not living happily ever after. So I went to him one Friday, and I said, "Hey, I noticed that a lot of times your drummer doesn't show up, and so I'm going to be the drummer in the band." He said, "Have you ever played drums before?" And I said, "That's just details. We'll work it out." I went that Saturday with the bass player to a pawn shop, and I got me a whole trap set of drums. I'm talking about the bass drum, two ride toms, a floor tom, a crash cymbal, a hi-hat, a snare drum. Monday night, I was the drummer in the band. You can't say that we pre-Al-Anons are not determined people. I thought I needed to be there to help him and to keep an eye on him, and I became the drummer in the band. And I played the drums all over Texas. I played drums for people that y'all would recognize. I became a very, very good drummer. And, oh, did I forget to tell you I still had that baby that's up there in the hotel room? And some nights, after somebody had been in concert in Dallas or Fort Worth or Houston, some night some very famous person would find out where we were playing, and they would come to our bar, the bar that we were playing at, because they knew we could have the after-hours party. That's when the law says you have to lock the doors at 1 o'clock, and we keep on making music and drinking and partying all night long. They would come to find out where we were, because that's where the action and the party was going to happen. Well, I would be a very good mom. I would go upstairs and I'd take the phone off. The babysitter would have to go home. I mean, she couldn't stay all night long. This might be on a Wednesday night or whatever. And so I would take the phone off the hook. I'd go back downstairs in the bar. I'd take that phone off the hook. And I'd sit up there watching them drink and have a good time. And I'd play the drums. And every now and then I'd go over and I'd listen to see if my daughter was awake. I think family services would have a problem with that. As well they should, a young child left up in a hotel room by herself. Now, during this time that we're living happily ever after and we're on the road, we got off the road a couple of times, but that didn't work out, and we'd get back on the road. And in that marriage of 16 years, we probably moved 13 times, and there were about 8 years in there that we lived even without an address. Now, the disease is busy. And I think if you look at the history of Lois and Bill, there were times that they lived on the road on their motorcycles. There were times that they lived without a home. And what I know about the disease of alcoholism is the person stands in front of you and they say, I think it's going to be better if we move to Houston. And I say, I do too, and I'd pack it up. And it's not that he was lying to me. It's because he believed it also. But what I know about the disease of alcoholism, you pack up the books, you pack up the kids' toys, you pack up the pots and pans, and you pack up the disease and you move it on down the road. You don't outrun it. It wants you. It wants all of you, and it wants your dreams. And this is the lifestyle that we lived. Finally, this man told me that we were going to move to Nashville, Tennessee, because he was a wannabe songwriter and singer. And so I'm going like, oh, it's like I've been holding my breath. But now we're going to live in Nashville, Tennessee. This has to be the last of the moves. I had become pregnant with our second daughter. There's 8 years between my girls. And so I had retired from being the drummer in the band. And now I'm thinking we're going to live in Nashville. Being in music is an accepted business. We are going to live happily ever after. But by this time, the music industry is a serious business, and by this time, my husband, the party had become more important than taking care of business. And he had some success, and he had made some bad judgments, and he walked in one day and he said, pack up, we're leaving. We're going back to Texas. And I have to tell you, at that moment, I was so very, very old, I could not pack another cardboard box. And I said, I can't. I'm not going. The girls and I aren't going. And he said, well, I guess we'll just have to get a divorce. Now, I had been asking for a divorce a few years before then, but he'd always say, we can't afford to get a divorce, whatever that means. And he said, this time he said, I guess we get a divorce. And I said, I guess we do. My neighbor was an attorney, and I paid him $50, and I got my divorce. And he packed up his music stuff, his guitars, his, you know, all of that. And he took off and went back to Texas. And in the rearview mirror, he left a 1-year-old, a 9-year-old, and an ex-wife whose resume said drummer in the band. And so now it's time for us to live happily ever after. And the attorney that handled my divorce said, you're going to need another job. Are you going to need a job, actually? And he said the 24th floor of the First American Center in downtown Nashville, of this high rise, there's a gentleman that has a commercial real estate company, and he's looking for someone to manage his office. I did not know how good my control skills could be converted into business management. And I interview for this job, and I get this job, and now we're living happily ever after. I expect my 9-10-year-old daughter to be the person making the bread at home, and I'm going to be out there making the bread, making the money to buy the bread, and we are going to live happily ever after, all these girls in this house. And I have to tell you that I chased the dollar. I became very successful, and I neglected my daughters. You know, I had to be out there making the money. Now, this man that I work for, he started asking me out on dates, and I said, but aren't you married? And he said, that's just details. We'll work it out. And after I'd been working for him for a few years and very, very successful, I was very successful in business because I showed up, and I wore silk dresses, and I was in business meetings with a bunch of attorneys doing really big deals, and I didn't cry. I'm telling you, I'm a woman, and I got things done. I might have been neglecting my daughters. I might have been, you know, going without ever thinking about, well, I sent my daughters to school with a fever because perfect kids don't get sick. I'm the one that, you know, caused all your kids to have strep throat, because I sent my kids on because I've got to go to work. I didn't have time to be a mother. I had to work. So this man divorced, and he asked me out, and then he asked me to marry him. And I thought, well, this is good. This is really good. He's a businessman. He's not in the music business. You know, we've got this business together. This is great. We're going to live happily ever after. And so I married this man. He adopted my two daughters. I have to tell you that in that marriage, I lived across the street from the governor in Nashville, Tennessee. I had a house that had 6 bathrooms. Man, I've got it together. My girls are in private school. I'm driving fancy cars. We've got a fleet of sailboats. We're traveling all over the world sailing. I've got it together. But something was missing, and I couldn't tell you what it was. I'd go to my doctor, and I'd say, I think something's wrong. I think something's wrong with me. Something's wrong. And he'd look at my lifestyle and my address, and he'd say, what do you have to complain about? And I'd go away. I'd talk to one of my girlfriends, and I'd say, something really is wrong in my house. I don't know what it is, but I've got this feeling. And they'd say, didn't you just get back from the British Virgin Islands, sailing down there for like 3 weeks? What do you have to complain about? So I'd be quiet. And this went on for a lot of years that I was just crazy. We were the looking good and feeling bad family. Our whole lifestyle looked like a movie set. It looked absolutely perfect. And I am absolutely going crazy. And what I found out was this man that I was married to, he was a cocaine entrepreneur. That's what you say rather than drug dealer when you live across the street from the governor's mansion, okay? And so things were crazy. Things were crazy in our life. And we'd have really bad fights. And I wanted this marriage to work. I didn't want a second failed marriage. So I looked up this doctor in the phone book, and we would go to marriage counseling. And we would go in, and I would cry and cry. And my then husband would sit in his chair and rock back and fold his arms. And the doctor would blah, 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 blah. You're too sensitive, he'd say to me. And he'd go, you're not sensitive enough. Go away. You know, pay me and go away. So this was our lifestyle, making lots of money, looking good, girls in private school. My oldest daughter began her journey into drugs and alcohol. She's acting out. My 8-year-old daughter, her body had turned into that of a young woman at 8 years old. So I am a crazy woman. I am a successful crazy woman because in the business situation, I could control everything. But my personal life was absolutely awful. Now, my husband would always go on these holidays, so it was Valentine's Day, and he and his buddy, his very best buddy, probably his buddy in his entrepreneurship. So we would travel with him, and sometimes we'd travel with the wife, or sometimes we'd travel with the girlfriend, but we would travel with him. Now, these guys had gone down to Miami to kind of get ready for the girlfriend and I to fly down there on Valentine's Day. So I had to stay because I had this really big deal, and I am absolutely exhausted. They pick us up at the airport, and we start driving down from Miami to the lower Florida Keys. And they're doing a party all day long. I'm over in the corner, absolutely exhausted. But this is a holiday. It's going to be wonderful. We're going to live happily ever after. And they finally stop for dinner. It was dark, and I know it was a nice place because there were tablecloths on it. And I remember we sat there, and we're with his very best friend and his very best friend's girlfriend, and then my husband and me, and with this little table, and we're going to be so happy. And then I said something wrong. I said, "Pass the salt, please," or I said, "Please pass the salt." But whatever I said triggered something. And my husband looked at me, and he said, "I'll tell you something. If there was a firing squad here, and my friend was standing there, and you were standing there, guess who was going to get shot? It would be you." And I thought, this doesn't sound happily ever after, does it? You know? And something snapped in me, and I got up, and I said, "I'm going home. I'm going home." They thought that meant I was going to the hotel. But no, I went in and I asked the lady there at the restaurant to call me a cab. Now, in the Lower Keys, it's only like four blocks wide. But she called me a cab, and he picked me up, and he said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, "I want to go to the Miami airport." And it's, you know, it's probably like late at night by now. And this cab driver says, "You know, well, I'm sorry, but this cab won't make it. I've got to go home and get the van." I'm going like, whatever, you know, just whatever. Just get me to the airport. I'm an efficient businesswoman, and this situation isn't going right, and so I'm going home, and stomp, stomp, stomp. And so he drives up in front of this little house. You know, I've done a lot of things, but I've never been home with a cab driver. But here I am, you know. And so he said, "Look, I've got to get the van ready. You go in," and about that time this door opens, and this woman says, "Hey, honey, come on inside and wait in here." And I have to tell you that I went up to that door and I stopped. This was a very, very sweet, simple house that I'm looking into. I stand at the front door. She's folding clothes there on the couch. I can see the stove back there, and there's some bubbly soup going on, and I guess their bedroom was on this side. And I have to tell you that I stopped at that door and I said to myself, this is a home. And I'm going back to a mansion, and I see this as a home. And it got to me. And she said, "Honey, it looks like you're having a bad time. Is there anything I can do to help?" And I said, "Well, yes, I had on a sundress and flip-flops, and that February there were 2 inches of snow in Nashville, and I said, I'd like to buy a pair of those socks." And she said, "Well," she was one of those angels, one of those guardian angels that come into our lives that we don't even know how important they are at the time. She said, "Honey, I'll just give you these socks. Now, you get on in, and he's going to take you to the Miami airport." Now, she was a great businesswoman. She was kind enough to give me the socks. She trusted me with her husband to go to the Miami airport, and she made me pay her in cash. She was a good businesswoman. So I get to the Miami airport, and by this time it's probably 1 or 2 in the morning, and the Miami airport at that time was under construction, so it was open for people off in the city to come into the airport. It wasn't secure, and there were no flights out at whatever time I got there. I mean, I'm thinking, I'll get a flight back to Nashville. Oh, I'll just get a flight to any place. I don't care. I'd given her all my cash, but I had my credit card. You know, I've got this under control. But there were no flights anywhere. And because that airport was open to the outside public, it was not a safe place to be. And I spent the rest of that night hugging my backpack with my back up against the wall, just trying to stay safe. And out of harm. And I hugged that backpack, and I got my back up against the wall, and I said a prayer. I didn't know it was a prayer, but I said a prayer. I said, God, my life is unmanageable. Now, unmanageable was not a word that showed up in my vocabulary. You know, I managed shopping center. I managed a household. I managed events, you know. I managed parties. I managed everything. My life was not unmanageable. But I very clearly said, God, my life is unmanageable. I probably hadn't said a prayer except now lay me down to sleep with my daughters. I did not know that was a prayer. I get back to Nashville a couple of days later. My husband shows up, and I thought I'd seen him mad before, but we came in and he was angry. And we know what anger sounds like. It's the plate of food up against the wall. It's the lamp slamming. It's skin against skin. We know what anger sounds like. And I saw in that man that I'm in big trouble because I'd never seen him that angry before. But because I am a good manager and because this is before cell phones, I said, remember that doctor, the doctor we used to go to that tell me I'm too sensitive and you're not sensitive enough? And I'm just trying to buy some time to stay safe. I said, why don't I call that doctor and see if we can see him? Now, this was a silly plan because this doctor, you had to call and get appointment out weeks ahead of time to get in to see this doctor. He was very, very famous, and he, you know, and this, I'm just trying to buy some time. So the number was there by the phone. I call this doctor. I said, hey, we're, you know, blah, 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 and we really need to see the doctor. And she said, this little voice says, well, we just had a cancellation, and if you can be here in 15 minutes, the doctor can see you. God is already working in my life, and I didn't even know it. So we walk in, and this is the doctor that would, you know, always tell me, you're too sensitive, you're not sensitive enough. And he would sit there with his arms folded, and my husband would, and I'm sitting there crying. I expect this. But I was just trying to buy some time, because if you think anger is noisy, the silent in that car driving to that doctor was absolutely deadly. The silent anger was absolutely deadly. So we go in there, and this time the doctor jumps up and he says, hey, come in. And he tells me to sit down and my husband to sit down. And he's kind of gets around behind his desk and he's all eye contact with us. And he goes, well, you know, my name is Dr. So-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have to make amends to you because I haven't always been as present as I should have been. So from that meeting, the doctor's appointment to the other doctor's appointment, the man had gotten in recovery, and he was a changed person. God is working in my life, and I didn't even know it. He said, look, things were different back then. This was like, you know, this was probably like 80, it was 86, because I got into Al-Anon in 87. Things were different. He said, my wife and I were going to go up for 1 week to this marriage counseling, and we can't go. And so here are the tickets, and here's the registration, and I'm going to give it to you free. Y'all just go and go. So the next day, I'm on an airplane to South Dakota. I mean, my life is moving fast. An airplane was always one of the favorite places. Airplane was always a favorite bar of my husband. So they pick us up at the airport, and that's the condition that we're in. He's been on a party. I'm absolutely terrified. But we're going up to South Dakota, and we're going to do 1 week long in this couples retreat. And I am excited. Finally, we're going to get to work on our marriage, our relationship. You know, this little couple's retreat, it was so cute. Everybody holding hands around the lake and going into dinner around the lake. It looked like Noah's Ark. You know, it was just so cute. And then when it was our turn to work on our stuff, they would take him into that other room. And I'm going like, how can we work on our marriage if you have him in that other room? What I know now, this is not about saving relationships. It's about saving lives. And they had him in that other room trying to break through his denial of his drug addiction and his other addictions. So I did learn the Serenity Prayer. We're getting ready to get on a taxi to go back to the airport. And the director of that facility, who was a very famous man in recovery, he gave me this really big bear hug, and he said, He whispered in my ear, get yourself to Al-Anon. Now, we're up in South Dakota, and I'm thinking, Al-Anon, is that a Native American word? What does that mean? You know, I didn't have a clue. So we get back to Nashville, and, you know, if you've got a little bit of exposure to recovery, it makes it really hard to stay in denial. And things didn't get better. They got worse. Because we had a little bit of information that we might not be doing it right. So things really got bad. Now, I could hide out at work during the week, but the weekends were awful in my household. And one Monday, I've absolutely fallen apart. And I'm at my very organized desk. I kept two secretaries busy all the time. I've got this big business going on. I started my own company. I've got it all together. And I'm crying at my desk. And I'm going, I don't know what's going on. And then that little light bulb said, well, call Al-Anon. And I looked it up in the phone book. And a lady answered the phone. And I want to say thank you to anybody that answers phone at central office or at Al-Anon family groups. You are saving lives. And she said, hello. And I said, And she said, where are you? And I told her I was at my very organized desk on a Monday where I should be, and I was going to make a lot of money, and it was all good. And she says, oh, wait. She says, there's a meeting on Monday that's like two blocks from your office. It just started a couple of weeks ago. And it was at the Monday Midday Methodist Publishing House. They started a meeting, and she said, you go over there, and they'll give you some literature. They'll tell you about Al-Anon, and I just want you to go over there. That's what she told me. You go over there at noon. I said, okay, I can do that. So, you know, 11 o'clock comes around. I've kind of got it all together now. You know, I don't know why I called that woman. I don't know why I told her those things. I didn't want anybody to know those things. And now she wants me to go over to this Al-Anon thing and at noon. And, I guess I told her I'd go. I said, oh, well, I'll go. They probably just want me to donate some money, you know, because that's what I thought. So I go over there, and I knock on the door, and I'm standing outside of the meeting, and I've heard something that I've heard here, and it was laughter. And it had been a long time since I'd heard that wonderful, healthy belly laughter. And I said, what's that noise? And you said, come on in. And they greeted me. They let me sit down. They let me cry. They let me sing the hymns. Don't you sing at your meetings? Hymns? Him did this and him did that. And you let me stay. And you let me stay. And I got a sponsor. Now, this sponsor knew me so well, she said, you're not going to do service work for a year because you'll get in there and you'll try to be president, and we don't have presidents. Mm-hmm. So for a year, I was in working the steps and following her to all meetings all over. I ended up being very active in Al-Anon. We didn't have our intergroup office. I helped negotiate that lease. I started speaking. I'm you know, living happily ever after, except it wasn't working out with this man that I was married to, that our journey in recovery wasn't parallel. So we got divorced. It took a long time. It was like a business divorce. It really was. It took 2 years to get that divorce. But I'm still going to meetings. I'm living happily ever after. Once again, I'm the breadwinner. I've got my daughters. I move out of that house across the street from the governor's mansion, and I get into this wonderful house in the Green Hills part of Nashville, and it had a separate apartment upstairs. It had a cottage. I mean, and for that period of time, active in Al-Anon and newly divorced and going to open AA meetings, my sponsor recommended that. She said, you go to open AA meetings never to talk, but you need to hear the stories of hope and encouragement. So I've been going to open AA meetings. I made friends with some AA women. And if you are an Al-Anon with a truck, you get to move a lot of AA women. And this house where my oldest daughter had gone off to college, but my youngest daughter was still there. And that house became like a retreat house or I don't know what you'd call it. Women started living there and their children started living there. And it was noisy and loud and fun. There were times that I'd have a baby bed in my office. You know, in my home office. And we were women laughing and having a good time. And we'd say, okay, let's, you know, the older kids would babysit the younger kids. And so we'd get all dressed up and we'd say, where are we going to go? You know, because we were all single. And where are we going to go? We're going to go out. Oh, I guess we go to a meeting. You know, that's what we do. And we'd talk about men, of course, you know, and we'd talk about being lonely, and somebody would get married and move out, or, you know, somebody get a boyfriend and move out, and somebody else would move in. We'd have these big parties. It was a wonderful time. We would have parties like I think this fish fry like we're going to go to in the backyard. I can remember one time we had all these bubbles, and we stood over the air conditioner and held these bubbles, you know, and the air comes out. We're just blowing these bubbles over the, I mean, it was the simplest things that made us so very, very happy. Because we were in the journey of recovery. So it was a wonderful place for us to live. But, you know, I had a dog, a cat, a gerbil, a rabbit, and a fish. And a guinea pig. Scott said I had a food chain living in my house. And I told my friend, I said, you know, I'm lonely. I'm lonely. And she said, well, didn't you know Scott was going to be he was getting a divorce? I said, Scott, from this open AA meeting I've gone to for like, you know, 2-3 years now, I thought he was really happy man. She said, no, he's getting a divorce. And so I'm going like, wow. So I go back to this open AA meeting, and evidently my behavior changed. Because I'm thinking, that's my worst enemy to be thinking. But I'm thinking, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm lonely. Scott's gonna be unmarried. I'm lonely, and I'm leaving the meeting, and he steps right in front of me, and he said, can I ask you something? I said, well, sure. He said, have I done something to offend you? And I said, well, why do you even ask that? And he said, well, you don't have eye contact. You don't go to lunch with us anymore. You don't stay around and chat. You don't hug. He said, you know, he said, I just was wondering what was going on. And I stood there and I said, I found out that you're going to be single and I'm interested. And then I bolted for my pickup truck. And before cell phones, I had to wait till I got home, and I called my sponsor, and I said, he did this, and I said this, and blah, 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 blah. And she goes, well, I think it'll be okay because you told the truth. And so when Scott's divorce was final, he called and he asked me out, and we dated, and, you know, we went to meetings, you know, that's how. And he courted me. We did not move into the bedroom right away. We kept that a decision that we made together. It was a wonderful thing. It was a wonderful thing. And we dated for about a year, and he asked me to marry him. And what a wonderful thing. We had a marriage. Our wedding, one of our friends says, well, that's the best AA meeting I've ever been to. Because we had the Serenity Prayer, and it was wonderful. We got married at the Bluebird Cafe there in Nashville, Tennessee. So now, wow, it's happened. I'm going to live happily ever after. It is so good that my oldest daughter names her firstborn after Scott. I mean, we have found it. And it is wonderful. Scott and I get invited to speak. We end up going all over the world. We've been to Russia. We've been to Australia. We've spoken in every state in the United States except Alaska. And it was magic. And then something started happening. I got that radar here that something was wrong. Something was very wrong. And And I'd go to Scott and I'd say, it feels like you're looking for the exit door. And he'd say, well, it looks like you're pushing me toward it. So I'd go away. And I'd go to my sponsor and I'd say, something is not right here and I don't know what it is. And she'd say, well, do you think he's drinking? No, no, I don't think so. He said, well, do you think? He's a wonderful AA member. He tells them that all the time. And the beauty of it is I can say that with a sense of humor now. But Scott was off speaking one weekend, and Sunday, before he was going to come back that Sunday night, one of my sponsees and two AA women showed up my door, and she says, I've got to tell you something. And the truth was, he'd become involved with one of my sponsees in an inappropriate way. And you think that would have been the end of the world, but I have to tell you, I felt nothing but relief. Because that meant that I wasn't crazy, that something had been going on. Now, he came home. We had disclosure now. It was information that we could work with. And we really, really tried to do that for like 2 years after disclosure. We stayed together 2 more years. But something just still wasn't right. And I don't know. I got so sick before disclosure because I was trying to work my program good enough, high enough, deep enough to affect his program. And I completely lost myself. I'd gotten into the confusion that detachment and denial were the same things. I thought I was detaching, but in truth, I was in denial about some of his activities. And so now I was not a healthy person. You know, he was living with a not healthy person. And so after disclosure, we lived together 2 more years and then we divorced. And I think that he had to go off and fight some demons and I had to go off and find forgiveness. And so we were divorced for 5 years. And during that time, I tried dating. I'm perfect Al-Anon. I opened up a bar. I mean, a bar and restaurant. I mean, I did, and but I couldn't get him out of my head. He was like a haunt. And I would tell God, I said, God, you know, sometimes it's like this, God, you know, if he's not supposed to be in my life, why is he still in my head? You know, what's really going on here? And I date, and they were alcoholic. They, you know, a lot of them were falling down alcoholics. And there was just the things I couldn't do all the time. I was still thinking about him. And finally, I said, well, God, if I'm going to think about him, I'm going to have to take some action. And evidently, Scott had been thinking about me, too, because he was in Florida for Sandy Beach's memorial, and I was in Florida in the same city on business, and I said, why don't we just get together, and we won't be around our old, you know, not our hometown, it'll be different territory, let's just get together and talk, and so we got together, and it was just like magic, it was unbelievably wonderful, and I said, well, now I'm going to have to go down and do some business in Key West, and I'm going to be there if you'd like to come for a couple of weeks, why don't you come down there, and he goes, okay, I'll do that, so he went to Key West with me, and about the third day there, he broke his leg and had to stay for 6 weeks, you know, and it was God's plan because he couldn't escape. and he didn't want to. So that happened about 3 years ago that we got back together. And now we're not legally married, but we're married by heart and we're sharing our lives and we're sharing our recovery. And I have to tell you, it's wonderful. And I loved, I had a little conversation with Elaine, and she tells her story that way too. It is okay for us to be happy that you're not going to kick us out. It's okay for us to live happily ever after. It's not easy. You know, Scott doesn't have very much wiggle room. I still have some anger. And I think it all has to do with grieving. Grieving is... It's a journey without a destination. I can grieve the lost time that we didn't have. I can grieve the loss of the dreams. I can grieve when I can't find my car keys. You know, I just have a lot of tears that I have to do. But the thing about grieving is it sometimes has anger in it. And I think I've had to go through that anger. And now we have a buzzword at our house. I start getting myself into a corner and Scott can see what's coming. So he can he'll say, volcano. And I'll go, oh, yeah, that I don't have to be angry to be heard. I can be more gentle. It says in our ODAT book that being human is not a defect of character. And that's all I'm bringing to this relationship is my humanness. And the disease has caused some of my humanness to have very harsh, jagged edges. And my recovery has allowed me to have a softer, kinder heart and to have gentleness. The bedroom had always been a problem with me because some things had happened to me that sometimes happen in an alcoholic home. And I'd have to do a lot of recovery and prayer around that. But the bedroom had not always been a safe place for me. And yet I really believe that this relationship was supposed to be celebrated like that. So I went to God in prayer and I said, I don't know what to do about this. And I was given what I call the bedroom prayer. And before Scott and I are going to celebrate our love for each other, I simply say, God, help me stay in the moment. And I share that because that's my whole prayer. God, help me stay in the moment. And then it takes away the damage that's happened to me before this relationship. It takes away my curiosity about what Scott was doing. If I stay in the moment, well, Mother Nature takes care of the rest, and I just wanted to share that. You know, prayer and meditation is so much an important part of my recovery because you gave me a gentle God. It starts out in our 12 steps about the God of our understanding, a higher power. And then when we get over into the traditions, you put an adjective in front of it, and it's loving God. And that's the God that I take with me everywhere I go. You know, before I got into Al-Anon, I had books on meditation. I was always seeking, you know, maybe I could levitate this table, you know, and, you know, all this. And then I get into Al-Anon, and there's that, you know, prayer and meditation. So, oh, meditation, oh, I've got to get the lights just right. And where's that candle? And put that music on. And, oh, no, I don't have time for meditation, you know. I'd spend so much time getting ready for meditation that it wouldn't work. And so I was given the gift that meditation is all around us. It's wherever we are. And what I do now, I have a container like a terracotta clay pot above my head, and I put good stuff in it, like our new puppy, the grandkids, laughter from a meeting, my wonderful sponsor. I put all this good stuff. And now I've got this collection of, and it's like a goo above my head. And you can use your container. It can be a jewelry box or cardboard box. It can be anything. But you just put the good stuff over there. And you may not have had time for meditation that day, but evidently I'm at the grocery store, and I've got to get this meal. And I've got to get home because I'm busy. And God must think that I have time for meditation because he puts this lady in front of me in the 15 items or less, and she's got 23 because I've counted them, you know. And I'm thinking, oh, God gave me this time. And then she starts to try to write an cash only. She's trying to write an out-of-state check. I mean, I'm going to be stuck here forever. But I remember this wonderful stuff that I have, and I just breathe, and then I just let it all pour out and go down me like wax going down the side of a candle. And I feel good about myself, and I feel good about her. And I can say, it looks like you're a visitor. Have a good time in our city, you know. I guess what I believe is that that this program, the AA and the Al-Anon, I don't speak for AA, but it says this, practice these principles in all of our affairs. That means that we're supposed to act the same way at home as we do at a meeting. That means we're supposed to act the same way at a meeting as we do refereeing our grandchildren's baseball. Unity. I think that's what we're looking for. When all of me finally shows up, that, and I like the person that finally shows up, then I'm standing in recovery. But my disease is also one of amnesia. I forget what you've taught me. I even forget what I believe. So I've got this little story that I'm going to close with. And it's about, I guess it's about having choices. You know, choices to come here or choices to call your sponsor. You know, choices to remember what you believe. So this is in this old-timey village, there was a woman, and she was like an old sage, very, very well-known and wise. And there was a young girl that was jealous of this old woman, and she wanted to trick her. So this young woman says, I've got this perfect plan. And this was her plan. She would catch a baby bird, and she would put it behind her back, and she'd ask the old woman, okay, old woman, you're so wise. You tell me whether or not this bird is dead or alive. And if the old woman said, well, honey, that bird is dead, well, then the girl would just show her the live bird. Or if the old woman said, well, that bird is alive, well, the girl would just squeeze the bird and then show her the dead bird. I mean, do you get it? This can't go wrong. This can't go wrong. So she pulls everybody around and says, okay, everybody watch this. This old woman thinks she's so all-knowing and so wise, but watch this. And she goes, I've got this baby bird. You tell me whether or not this bird is dead or alive. And the old woman, without hesitation, said, the choice is yours. The choice is yours. The choice is yours to go to a meeting. The choice is yours to go out with laughter. And the choice is all of ours to go eat catfish. God bless. ah.